Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome to Almost Famous, the podcast where I explore the subject of fame by talking to people who've experienced it themselves and ask them how it has affected their own journey as well as the lives of those around them. My guest today is musician and actor Chesney Hawkes. Chesney's career started at the age of 19 when he appeared in the film Buddy's Song. The movie featured Chesney's song The One and Only, which went on to top the UK singles chart for 5 weeks and reached the top 10 in America. The song pretty much has a life of its own, having appeared in other movies including Doc Hollywood, Moon, and Source Code. Chesney has since appeared on TV shows including The Games and Celebrity Big Brother for Channel 4, ITV's Tech Santa and Hit Me Baby One More Time, and Celebrity MasterChef and Let's Dance for Comic Relief on BBC One. Chesney has also appeared on stage in musicals Can't Smile Without You and Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat. Chesney is what I like to think of as one of our dream Almost Famous guests, as not only has he experienced fame himself, but he comes from a family of famous people too. Chesney's father is singer Chip Hawkes of 60s band The Tremolos, and his mother Carol was an actress too. So I'd love to give a huge Almost Famous welcome to Chesney Hawkes. Chesney, how are you?
Hey Barnaby, I'm great. Thanks for having me on.
No problem at all. You're in LA, so you're as remote as we've had on the show so far. And how are you dealing with the weird COVID?
Oh, am I your furthest guest?
You're my furthest guest. How are you dealing with like the weird COVID isolation?
Well, I'm locked in with my wife and three children, a dog and a cat. I mean, it's affected my business, as you could possibly imagine, dramatically, because most of my life, half of my life anyway, is touring. So I'm always away. I'm always on an airplane, going somewhere, on a ship somewhere, or going to a festival or touring. So obviously everything has completely stopped. I'm getting to know my wife and kids right now. It's crazy.
What the question I always ask my guests first is, what did you think of your intro? Did I miss anything out?
Oh, no, I think you did really well. I love it when I do interviews like this, whether it's radio or podcast or TV or whatever. I always love it when my interviewer has done his research, and you sound like you have definitely done that. Sometimes I just get people saying, just asking questions like, what was it like to have number one hit? And that's about it. That's about as far as I get sometimes. And normally that's kind of provincial radio, but you obviously know what you're doing here.
Well, I tried to do some research. Basically, it comes from the fact that I don't want to be embarrassed by anything once I get into it myself. I don't want to sound like I haven't made a good effort to get to know a bit about my guests. I also always ask this question. Some people find this question easy to answer. Some people don't. But I'm interested to see what you think. The question is, Chesney Hawkes, are you famous?
That's an interesting question. I guess yes would be the first answer that came out of my head, but not so much in some parts of the world. But I think I am famous, particularly in England. Yes, I mean I think I class fame as do people recognize you that don't know you? So the answer to that question is yes. I guess it's yes.
And in terms of that, I actually, having interviewed a lot of people and asked them that question, I kind of have a similar idea of what fame is. I think that's a good way of putting it. How often on a day-to-day, week-to-week, month-to-month basis, I guess, p- particularly when you're in the UK at the moment. How often does that recognition still come your way?
Well, when I'm in England and Europe, actually, as a whole, it's an everyday occurrence. Depending on where I am, you know, if I'm in the town that I lived in for like 10 years and my parents still live there, my brother lives there, everyone knows who I am. But it's because I was a dad at the school. I was kind of like the local celebrity, you know. So in that respect, that happens a lot. But like, you know, over here where I live here, one of the reasons that I moved over here was to kind of get away from that a little bit and to give the kids, a relatively normal upbringing and existence without having to kind of deal with that kind of craziness of fame. Because obviously there's all sorts of sides to it, they're positive and negative. But I do get recognised for sure. It's certainly in England.
And I think talking about your kids is a good thing because I can sometimes hear them in the background. I think tell us a little bit about your living situation in LA at the moment, so our audience know that when we hear them on Zoom doing classes in the background, there's a reason behind that.
Yes, or asking me questions, you know, like, what have you done with the cornflakes? Yeah, I mean, it's not the average place I would be. It would be recording a podcast. In fact, I know that we were originally planning to do this in London, weren't we?
We were.
So I'm doing this from my lounge, and I have my three kids here. I've got Casey, who is 18, and I have my daughter is 16, and I have a 14-year-old son. Who is obsessed with guitar. So hopefully he won't be picking up a guitar in the next 45 minutes, but it's hugely possible that I might have to interject and ask him to wear headphones.
No, that will be absolutely fine. And the audience will know no different because I will cut it out. But I think it's definitely good to have talked about that because this is then, you talked about your certainly one of your children loving music, and you, as I mentioned, are the son of a pop star as well, your dad Chip Hawk. So tell us a little bit about what it was like growing up with a famous dad and wanting to follow him into music as well.
Yeah, there's my brother and sister and I went into music in the end. I think, my brother's a drummer, my sister's a singer-songwriter, and I think that because we grew up in a household where there were guitars propped up in every corner, dad even had a little recording studio out the back, and all of his friends were 60s superstars like Jerry Marsden from Jerry and the Pacemakers, and Dave Dozy, Beaky, Mick and Titch were all like Uncle Dave and Uncle Dozy and Uncle Beaky, and you get the idea. So I kind of, dad was a very sociable guy, he was always throwing kind of parties where they'd have like a makeshift stage where, people would get up and jam. And, I grew up in a very, liberal kind of fun musical household. I think it's kind of in the blood, it's in the bones. I started singing from a very young age. Dad obviously kind of, he had an amazing record collection of Beatles and Stevie Wonder and in all these incredible records that I discovered, as a young man. When it came to the point where I knew what I wanted to do, it seemed like a natural course of action. That fame wasn't it wasn't a strange beast for me, because I knew a lot of famous people. My parents knew a lot of famous people. I was hanging around with famous people, so I'd kind of seen it. Even like going to my dad's gigs, and watching from behind the wings and seeing him do his thing and seeing fans and how they react and how people react to people that are famous. And it can be kind of a strange reaction sometimes when people, come face to face with someone they've seen on the telly. So I witnessed that as a kid with my dad and with my mum, actually, and mum and dad's friends even. My dad knew people like Mike Reed was a good friend of ours from, he was a Radio 1 DJ when I was a kid. And so, I would be woken up by listening to him on Radio 1. And then, the next day we'd be over for a dinner party with my parents. So I saw it, I lived it, and then when it came to be kind of my turn, it didn't seem like an alien thing, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, that makes total sense. Like the genesis of this podcast is because my mum had a number two hit in the 70s. My dad was in a Liverpool band called the Mojos, who's the lead singer in the 60s, and my stepdad in the 90s was Angus Deaton. So it's about exactly what you're just talking about, especially the first series where I interviewed other people who grew up around famous parents or famous siblings, and just that feeling for me and wanting to own those feelings of perhaps my childhood wasn't as in speech marks normal. Just hearing you talk like that in terms of the parties, and even to be honest, like my mum was friends with Mike Reed as well, so that made me laugh. But
that's so funny.
Believe it or not, audience, Chesney and I have never met. We've never had a conversation before, but we're finding out that we had probably a very similar liberal upbringing.
There's probably other people in common as well, Barnaby. Are we the same kind of age? Or?
You're a little bit older than me. Like I definitely, I'm 39, but I definitely remember when The One and Only came out and stuff like that. But I'm intrigued in terms of what you just talked about. You talk with such positivity about your childhood, and that hasn't always been the case with people I've interviewed. So there was never any sense with you at all that you kind of yearned for a more normal life or anything like that as you were growing up?
I didn't have that experience, no. For me, fame was something that I kind of wanted, because I always wanted to be a musician, always wanted to sing, always wanted to write songs. It was the path for me. And I don't think that there was ever anything else in my mind as far as what I wanted to do. You know, the only other job I had was as a paperboy at like 14 years old. So making music was my path. And of course, that was what my dad did. So I saw him as, you know, as a guide to where I was going to go. So for me, I didn't want anything else. It was magical. You know, the music industry was magical, or not the industry, just making music was magical. And I always knew that it was. So I didn't want, I was happy being in an interesting, different world. My family were fun. There were some crazy sides to it, I guess. You know, looking back, maybe that was a bit wild. But and I'm sure you can relate to that. There's certain things that happened that maybe I wouldn't do myself. But it was fun. It was mad. It was wild. And I have great memories from as a kid.
And I've watched this brilliant, I'm just going to implore the audience to watch this. Go on Chesney's website and watch this amazing video where you did a talk in LA and discussed how, in about 12 minutes, I'm going to ask you to make it a little shorter, but basically discussed how when you told your father that you also wanted to become a pop star, he basically gave you the summer holidays and said, if you're not a pop star by the end of the summer holidays, then you're going back to school. Could you just give the audience a little idea of what happened there and how it actually all came to fruition?
Yeah. When I left school at the age of 15, late 15, that's all I wanted to do was play music. And so my dad said, so what are you going to do here then? I said, well, I want to be a pop star or I want to be a musician, I think is what I actually said. That's what I want to do with my life. And he said to me, okay, son, if you're not earning money by the end of the summer in music, then you need to go to college because you need a backup plan. Which is not something that he ever did, I have to say. Although he was a trained carpenter from an early age, so maybe I'm misspeaking there. But I took that on board, and I went out, and I had already like played live and done a few little gigs. But I went out and I found gigs around the area. I went and played in pubs and wine bars and clubs and. By the end of the summer, I was doing weddings and, you know, all sorts of things around the area, playing kind of John Lennon, Barry Manilow and Billy Joel and Stevie Wonder songs and Elton John, you know, just sitting in the corner as the piano man. And by the end of the summer, I was actually doing pretty well and managing to kind of pay my way, as it were. Dad said, "Okay, so it looks like you're on the way then." And during that time is when my kind of break came along, where I auditioned for a part in a film. And the only reason I really wanted to do this film was because it was a way into the music industry for me, because the film was starring Roger Daltrey from The Who, and it was a musical kind of film. It was based in the music industry, and the kid was supposed to be a singer and a guitar player, and so I thought, well, that's my way into the music industry, you know. So I, in that time, I went and did that, and eventually ended up getting the part, which was, you know, incredible. Because there was a lot of people going up for that part, and I was just very lucky, right time, right place, and I was, you know, right for the part, and ended up getting that part. And so, but it wasn't quite by the end of the summer, but like literally a year later, I was well on my way there. So, you know, Dad stuck to his word, and I didn't have to go back to college.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, everyone. I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently. Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
But I'm interested because it feels like almost him putting that deadline on it probably helped give you the motivation to make sure that you were doing whatever it took to pursue that passion of yours. I'm also intrigued just to wonder whether if, because this was in the late 80s and back before X Factor, Pop Idol, any of those opportunities that I think now lots of young people use to try and find their way into the industry. I wonder if you've ever given much thought to how you would have found a way in had it not been for that opportunity.
It's funny, when I was about 16, something like that, you mentioned X Factor, there was a show on Sky called Search for a Star. I don't know if you remember it, you were probably too young.
I vaguely remember the name.
Yeah, it was Sky Star Search is what it was called, sorry. And Keith Chegwin was the host. And I actually had a band at the time called Adrenaline.
Brilliant.
And my brother was the drummer. I know, yeah. And I had, you know, crazy long mullet and a crystal cross in my ear. And my brother was the drummer, and I had a guitarist, Gary Nuttall, who now has gone on to be Robbie Williams' guitar player. And we went on to that show. So it's funny. I know it's not quite X Factor, and it really wasn't, because Sky was not what it is now. It was a kind of, you know, an underground starting point for what Sky has become. Very, very early days, and nobody watched it, to be honest with you. It was one of those things. So I did actually go that route for a little bit. I didn't win it or anything. But it's hard to say what I would have done if I didn't have that that guidance from the old man. You know, I carried on that kind of need for deadlines with projects. I think it's a really, really important thing to have. And I think that probably was the first deadline I ever had, my dad saying that. And now when I do projects, like I'm writing a musical at the moment, and we're always giving ourselves deadlines to finish certain drafts, to finish certain songs, to maybe work towards a table read or something like that. And I'm the same with, I've just finished an album. We made sure that I had a deadline for all the music to be finished. And I think that is a very important thing. I know a lot of, authors and writers that say the same thing. If you give yourself a deadline, then, you have more of a chance of actually finishing something. I mean, I know in the past I have had projects that I've worked on that I just had no kind of end in sight. And, we just now and again, when we get together, let's just do like passion projects, whatever. And then we'll do another song for that. We'll do another song for that. But it never ends up getting finished. So I'm a big fan of deadlines, actually. And I think maybe that moment with my dad gave me, my first taste of that.
Yeah, I completely agree on it. As a creative person myself, I completely agree. And also, I just read an article today where the musician Charlie XCX was saying how she's doing this project during isolation, where she's recording her album all on her own and releasing it on her own and doing the artwork. And she's saying, basically, I don't know why I haven't worked like this before. And I think kind of giving herself a deadline to do this has really helped in that. You talked about the amazing process of how you got the film part. And in that film was the song The One and Only. We mentioned a little bit about at the top how people tend to only ask you about this, but I do need to go into it a little bit. What is it like being so well renowned for potentially that one moment, and that one moment having been right at the beginning of your career?
Well, that's a question that I do get asked, and not particularly in that way, actually. It was an interesting way of putting it, because it's something I think about quite a lot. I remember at the time. So I was, imagine this, 19 years old, and I was putting my first single out, and it started to climb the charts. There was a moment where, funnily enough, it went in the midweeks, which is something that doesn't exist anymore, but there was a thing back in the day, back in my day, in the late 80s and early 90s, where on a Wednesday you would get the midweeks. Which is a prediction of where the record is going to go, where it's going to come in on the Sunday. So it's a Wednesday and Thursday, you get the midweeks. And there was one week where I think the record was about kind of 60-ish. And then the midweek said it had dropped right out to 80-something, which normally in those days meant it's all over, the record's done. But so they didn't actually tell me, the record company didn't tell me. And that Saturday I did the Little and Large show, which was a huge Saturday evening entertainment show. And it did the job. It kind of put me back into the charts. And then it came into the top 40 that following week. And then people started to cotton onto it, I guess. And that's when there was a real rocket put under the record, and it started flying up the charts. And I remember it got to number 5 a couple of weeks later. And my manager at the time, Bill Kerbishley, who was also the manager of The Who and Led Zeppelin. So he had Led Zeppelin, The Who, and me. Interesting eclectic mix there. And so Bill Kerbishley, he brought us into me and the team into his office when it was number 5 and looking like it could possibly, go all the way up. And he said to me, I really hope this isn't a number 1. And so at the time, I just thought, well, he's lost his marbles here. Of course we want it to be number 1. But his reasoning was that it would be a really difficult thing to follow up. And it's a hard thing to move on from that and still kind of carry on a career, you know? And so I think what it's done to me, to have that kind of success on my first single, and the, and of course, you know, it being called The One and Only, I think, kind of added to that kind of, the cult of it in a way, that it's been difficult for me, to get away from. So there's the negative side of it. And, you know, people ask me, has it been an albatross around your neck, you know? And yes, I think in that respect, it probably has been. But if I look back at my career, I would never change what happened there, because it was an incredible experience for a start. That song, that record has become, as you said at the beginning, it kind of has a life of its own. It's, I call it a song with wings. You know, it did way more than it said on the tin. It went off, and now the great thing about what we do in music is, you know, people have connections with songs. And I think that The One and Only has become one of those songs where people remember it, and they have, you know, beautiful memories as from when they were children, or even like their first kiss, and all that kind of stuff. And so, so my thoughts about it are that I love it. And now when I play it live, it has a real like energy comes from the crowd, you know. And it's not just because I love to play it, but then the crowd, when I play it, when it opened just on that kind of iconic intro that it has there, and you can just literally feel the energy from the crowd, and then I feed off of that. So I'm proud of it, and I love playing it, and I also love to hear the stories that people have over the years. Like, for instance, just as an example, like, obviously it gets played at weddings and things like that, but it also gets played at funerals and stuff. And one example of that is, I had, this lovely message, email came through from a group of guys that had a friend of theirs that passed away, that where The One and Only was like his favorite song. And whenever they were out clubbing or at pubs or whatever, that when it came on, they would lift him up and he would sing it from on top of their shoulders, you know? And then after he passed at their funeral, they had The One and Only play at the funeral. And at that moment, when the song came on, they lifted him up in the coffin. You know, it's like you can't write that kind of stuff. It's a very, very emotional. And that's the kind of thing that music can do. It can change you, and it can take you back, you know. And the beautiful thing about nostalgia is it helps you kind of, you know, go back to a time when maybe things were in your mind, you know, better, or just, you know, more innocent. And I do love that about music.
Yeah, that's so great to hear you talk so proudly about it, because I've certainly heard, I've seen lots of interviews and heard lots of people who have tried to basically rid themselves of their past glories, for one reason or another, and I always find it a little bit grotty. I'm gonna ask a few questions kind of in one, but just because we're having some technical issues and you're talking really, really eloquently about this stuff. So I've you know, in my research, I've seen you talk about how you didn't make any royalties from The One and Only for like 10 years. I'm kind of intrigued to hear, on behalf of the audience who don't know much about the music industry, how that kind of thing works. But also then I've also seen you talk about how at the time you definitely spent the money that you got, or perhaps didn't get, too extravagantly, and kind of regret that. I wonder if you could talk us a little bit through that period of time.
Sure. Well, the way it works, or certainly worked in the industry back then, is you were signed to a record label, and in my case, a major record label, and they pay for everything. They pay for your travel. They pay for the record to be made, you know, studio time. They pay for the videos. They pay for your clothes. They pay for photographs. Everything, you know, comes out of the coffers of the record label. But what you don't realize at that time is that you have to pay everything back before you make any money. So in my case, a lot of money was spent. The videos were extortionate. I remember making one video for a single where we came over to LA and filmed in the desert and spent like $250,000. And I remember when we actually saw the final thing, It could have been filmed in a studio in Balham or something. You couldn't really tell the difference, you know. It was such a waste of money. And so for me, even though I had, you know, huge success with one single and then the album did really well as well. I never managed to kind of recoup what the money that was actually spent until 10 years afterwards. Like, you know, that was 91 when I put that record out. I never actually made any money from that record until 2001. And by then it was slightly different kind of money that was coming in. It was like syncs, as you say, the record was used in films and things like that. So it's not money that I could have lived on. And so that side of the industry is interesting for people that don't know it. And of course I did the classic thing when I first made it where there was money coming in, Barnaby, that, you know, don't get me wrong. I, you know, there was money from advances from publishing companies and merchandise. And so I did actually, you know, make good money in those days. But I did the classic, you know, young pop star thing where I just kind of spent it all. I bought everyone in my family a car. You know, I spent a fortune on an all singing, all dancing studio. You know, I had a convertible car myself, you know, and bought a house, and which was actually the best thing I ever did because I still had that house, which I'm so grateful for. But, you know, it was the classic pop star, you know, extravagance.
It sounds just like a kind of tale as old as time, doesn't it? Like, because my brother as well, he in the late 90s got a big record deal with Virgin. And I think even now we talk about how he made the mistake of not buying a house. So at least you did do that. That sounds like the best thing you possibly could have done. But at least buying the cars for your family, what a lovely thing to do.
No, they very much liked the fact that I bought them all the cars, believe me. and fun enough, you mentioned that house. I mean, right now, while we're in lockdown, we rent that house out, and it's the only money that's coming into the Hawks household right now, into Hawks Towers. So thank God.
Long live the one and only house, we'll call it. I went on your dad's website and he talked about how he gave up touring to be your manager in the late 80s. Is that right? And what was like mixing business with family like?
You know, that had its issues. It was great having him with me. I was young. It wasn't late 80s. It was early 90s when Dad did that. He just kind of came off the road from the Tremolos and decided to, you know, 100% be with me. And of course, my brother was with us as well. So he was 17 at the time. So we needed to have, you know, a parent or a guardian with us on tour. And Dad was the obvious choice. There were times when money gets involved with family where it can be tricky. I don't want to go too much into it, but you know, there were times when it was a little bit tough, but as a whole, it was great to have him on the road with us. You know, he'd been through it himself in the 60s, having lots of success. So he kind of helped us through the pitfalls and some of the crazy trappings that, you know, in trying to keep our head out of the clouds and feet on the ground. And I think one of the things that is very important if you have some kind of very fast fame is to have that, you know, people that are grounded and willing to and happy to be there for you and also tell you what's real and what's not, you know, because it's so easy to believe your hype and so easy to become, you know, Billy Big Balls, as it were, and start believing all the things that people say about you. And that's the other thing about fame that is difficult, you know, to try and keep your own integrity and yourself, because you lose a little bit of your life. And I think it was probably good to have family around me at that time.
Yeah, that makes...
In particularly my brother, funnily enough.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. I'm aware that you've got another Zoom meeting coming up in just about 10 minutes. So I'm gonna just kind of make the rest of the questions a little more, a little kind of quicker and a little smaller. Just before we go into kind of slightly more ones from with more pithy answers, I just wanted to go into kind of the end of your record contract, because I've seen you talk about how eventually your record label stopped returning your calls. How did that feel, and kind of, you know, was that really hard to kind of bounce back from?
Yes, that was a difficult time for me, looking back at it, because I was so young, and the huge success happened when I was 19. And what happens when you're part of a, you know, the record business machine is you have the same people around you all the time, and it becomes a little bit of a family. And there were, you know, girls and guys that around me that were very much, you know, for a few years, very much kind of everyday part of my life, and I counted them as almost family, you know. And so when I traveled all around the world with them, so we experienced all these crazy things together and had really amazing times together. So when it kind of started to go downhill as far as my relationship with the record deal and the record label, and then they ended up dropping me, and I couldn't get these people even on the phone, and they wouldn't return my calls. And, you know, I was sitting in a house that I just bought, having left my family home, without having all these people around me. It was difficult. It felt like, I always say this as an analogy where it felt like one minute I was in the club, in the VIP room, you know, with champagne flowing and everything that you could wish for as a young boy. And then, you know, the bouncer comes and kicks you out of the back door, and you end up, you know, on your ass in the on the curb there. And that's kind of how it felt. But I'm very, very glad that that did happen, because I feel like it made me a little bit more of a rounded person, having experienced the highs and lows of the business and of life in a way.
Yeah, you really come across as if you've obviously... That to me sounds like a kind of big mental health moment to recover from, but it sounds like you are such a grounded person that you've, despite having been through the ringer on that front, you've kind of come out with it of it all with this positivity. That's really great. I'm just going to ask some now kind of more quick fiery questions, so if you can come up with some pithy answers. We ask all of our guests these. So first off, what's the best thing about being famous?
I would say best thing about being famous, well, in the old days, it was like getting into clubs for free. You know, that was always, there was always like, my friends always loved my fame because I could always get them into these great places. These days, it doesn't work quite like that.
And great answer. And what's the worst thing about it?
Worst thing about fame is that you lose your own choice in life. You can't do certain things. Like, I remember, you know, one day being able to go to the pub or go to the cinema or even just walk down the street. And then the next day I had to kind of hide in the back of my brother's car just to get out. And you can't really do, when you had the height of fame that I had, you can't really just pop into the pub without, you know, just have a quiet pint with a friend, because you're just going to get lots of hassle. I don't mind talking to people. In fact, I love meeting people. And these days it's not quite the same kind of craziness. So I would say that's probably the worst thing.
Okay, great. And one thing that's in common with most of the people I've interviewed is the press having printed bullshit headlines or articles about them. I wonder if you can think of the biggest example of lies you've read about yourself.
Oh my goodness. I mean, over the years, there's been so many different things written about me. This one isn't particularly a lie as such, but... one of the crazy things about being famous is that obviously the press want stories about you. So I had a girlfriend at the time, and I was you know, classic kind of 19-year-old pop star boy, and I was a bit of a naughty boy and went and lied on a beach with another girl. And at the time, it was known that I had a girlfriend, and of course that's the most salubrious thing, and it's all they want, isn't it? The red tops. So they followed me, took pictures of me, and then basically came up to me with this huge lens, this guy, and said, right, well, we have the story and the pictures, so either you do the story with us, or we're just going to print what the hell we want. And so I decided I would, you know, talk to them and tell them the truth. but I hadn't told my girlfriend, obviously. So that was one of the hardest things I had to do, was to call my girlfriend and say, you might want to pick up the son tomorrow, or you maybe don't want to pick up the son tomorrow, but this is what's happening. And it was a very difficult time, that, and all of my neighbors were offered crazy amounts of money, and all my family were offered money to do stories on me and, you know, tell, dish the dirt, as it were. So I definitely went through the ringer with that one.
Oh, Chesney, the classic, yeah, like you said, the classic naughty boy, famous person stuff. We've had a, yeah, we've had a few of those. Two more questions. The next one is, who's the most famous person in your phone?
Jamie Oliver.
Oh, very good. Yeah, very good. And the final question, Chesney, we ask all of our guests this, knowing all that it entails and with the benefit of hindsight, would you give up fame if you had the chance? By which I mean, you'd have the same life you have now, you have the same finances, you'd still be a musician, it's just no one would ever recognize you. Would you change that?
No, I wouldn't. I'm not one for regrets at all. I like what happened to me as a young man. And I think it still affords me to earn a living. So I'm very grateful to it. And I'm also grateful for the platform, because with fame, you are also able to raise awareness for certain charities. So I would be sad to see that go.
Brilliant answer. Thanks so much for coming on the show, Chesney. Just before I leave with the outro, is there anything you'd like to plug? You mentioned an album. Where can people go to hear your work? All of your social media stuff. You've got an audience. Tell them where to find your stuff.
Oh, thank you, Barnaby. Well, all things Chesney Hawkes, you would go to chesneyhawkes.com. But I've been working on a new concept here in lockdown, where I'm actually doing live Zoom concerts from my living room. And if you're interested in coming to see those, they are a lot of fun. You go to liveandunfiltered.com and you can buy tickets there, and it tells you all about it. I also give some of the proceeds to a chosen charity of the week. I've got one this Friday for workers and volunteers of the NHS. So there you go. You either go to chesneyhawkes.com or liveandunfiltered.com.
Fantastic, and an excellent cause. Thanks, guys at home, for listening to this episode of Almost Famous. Please do press that subscribe button, rate the podcast, leave us a comment too. Find us on Instagram at Almost Famous the podcast, and on Twitter at Pod Almost Famous. And until next time, thank you, Chesney Hawkes, so much. Been a brilliant guest. Goodbye.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.